Welcome to Design Downtime, the podcast where we celebrate the joys of living a balanced creative life. I'm your host, Guy Siegel, a design director in Toronto, Canada, and I invite you to join me on this journey as we redefine what it means to be a successful design professional. Let's break free from the shackles of hustle culture and embrace the full spectrum of human experience, because life is too precious to be spent only in pursuit of productivity. Today, I'm thrilled to talk to Anthony Hobday. Anthony thinks about interface design a lot. He shares everything he knows on his website. He prefers a systematic approach to design, but has passionate interest in visual design. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Today, you want to talk about solo tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah, I care a lot about definitions, and I was thinking about this earlier today. I realized that when I describe what I design as solo tabletop role-playing games, there's some nuance there. So just in case there's any huge tabletop role-playing game fans, TTRPG fans listening, one of the most important things I've realized about role-playing games is interpretation. So here's the thing that's happened. How do you as the player interpret that? One of the things I don't like about games is interpretation. I want the game to tell me what's happening explicitly. And so I did want to say that now I think of myself more as a solo tabletop game designer. And a lot of those include very strong role-playing game elements, if you're familiar with, you know, role-playing video games. But I suspect there are some people out there who would disagree or argue about the definition. That's maybe the definition I started with, but it's not the definition I currently think of myself as, sort of the niche I currently occupy. And as a designer, I know that we both have experienced that a lot in the design culture, because no one can define anything for more than 5 minutes before we're on to the next job title or the next, skill set name, whatever it happens to be. So I thought I'd get that out of the way, because we might say TTRPG a lot in this show. I don't want anyone screaming into their headphones about definitions, because I really do prefer everything to be, as you said in my intro, systematic and very explicit. That's something I enjoy a lot. So that really affects the types of games I design.
The first question is usually the origin question. And I know for myself, I've become aware of solo TTRPGs in recent years. I don't know how far back they go, but I'm really curious to know, when did you become aware of solo TTRPGs?
It's a good question. I'm not actually sure I can tell you. I remember I started to design a game that was played on cards, essentially. Okay, so I think I do have it, right? So I started going to a local group that plays in a board game shop, and we play a social deduction game called Blood on the Clock Tower, which is similar to Werewolf, on which is based the TV show Traitors, which I usually like to give as a sort of cultural touchstone, because lots of people have heard of Traitors and they don't necessarily know it's based on a much older game. Many people have taken that concept and expanded it. And so I go to this board game shop and I play this game every Monday. And I think being around those board games so much and exploring what they've got on the shelves maybe started things that are grabbing my interest. And so I started looking into dungeon crawling board games. And then I started to think about designing my own dungeon crawling board game, which is not, you know, necessarily a TTRPG. But once I got into that interest, you sort of follow these rabbit holes when you watch YouTube videos or you look at what's available. I started collecting examples of the, you know, state of the art, the other games that are available. And I came across pen and paper solo role-playing games. And so this is its own whole rabbit hole. And there's a lot of people who are making games in this area. And because I was interested in designing my own, essentially, board game, but struggling with the idea of having these components printed on cardboard and everything, I kept running into this idea in my head of, okay, but how do I get this stuff printed without sending it off to some company that charges me £100 per print run and sends stuff back? You know, I was buying little cards and I was writing things on them manually, but I sort of had in my head this idea of building a game and then selling it to people, you know, in a box, which is a bit ambitious, especially for a first game. But then, yeah, like I said, then I discovered this idea of solo tabletop role-playing games, and especially ones where you essentially drew out your dungeon map as you're exploring it. And that appealed to me a lot more, because suddenly I could just write a Word document. I use Pages because I'm on Mac. I could just write a word processing document which explains the rules. And that includes everything, like, you know, how to draw the dungeon map, what happens when you go to each new room. And all you would need, and all you need for most of these tabletop role-playing games, is pen and paper, and usually a set of dice, different types of dice for different purposes. And that's pretty much it. You could maybe get some other things that would help you keep track of stuff if you didn't want to keep track of it all by writing it down and, you know, crossing it out and writing it down again. But that's what most people do, is they just have a piece of paper that acts essentially as their scratch pad, their journal, and they're keeping track of the things that are happening step by step in this game they're playing. And really, you're taking what most people are familiar with as video games, and you're instead keeping track of all the logic and the maths yourself. And so that they naturally have to be a bit simpler, but the trade-off or the benefit of that simplicity is it's much easier to design this sort of thing and produce this completed artifact and then put it on the internet and let people download it and play it. And so that's a relatively short summary of that journey of I started wanting to design a game like the ones I was seeing on the shelves, I suppose, in this board game shop. It feels like it's been such a long time now that I think that's the origin story, and I'm not quite sure. I'm a bit fuzzy on the details. It hasn't really been that long, but it's been long enough, and there's been so many twists and turns that it's hard to remember. But yeah, now then my first real success, if you want to call it that, was at the point where I could just write up a word processing document, export it to PDF, and then upload it online, and then suddenly people were downloading it and trying it, and maybe you get some feedback. That was a very satisfying feedback loop.
When you design these games, how far do you go? Do you impose any sort of constraint to yourself? Do you say, you know what, I'm going to do a one-page game? What are parameters that you play with?
Yeah, so I really like arbitrary constraints in general in life. If I can arbitrarily constrain something, I find that quite fun. And so it's a good question to ask, because one thing I do like to do, not always, but sometimes, is I'll say, how mechanically, this is something I've done with one of my games that's available online now, is I've said, how mechanically dense can I make this game but keep the rules to one page of A4? So not front and back, just one side. And so essentially a challenge where I'm saying, okay, I need to use shorthand for almost everything and assume that the audience knows what they're talking about or knows what these words mean. And I need to think about how these mechanics can interact with each other in a way that they create more mechanical complexity, but you've got less mechanics sort of in absolute terms. So you can say, oh, you've got this one statistic for your character and a different statistic, and they maybe combine with each other to essentially act as a third statistic that affects how you handle combat or something. That's one way I've done that, and I really enjoyed that, and it was, I don't know how to measure popularity exactly, but it was quite popular in relative terms to the rest of my games. I usually essentially boast in my descriptions of the games about the number of pages that the rules fit onto, because some, especially tabletop role-playing games, you buy them and it's a book, and it's a hardback, you know, book that's been printed and sent out to you, and they'll boast about how it's 200, 300 pages of rules, and there is never a chance in a million years I want to read a 200-page book so that I can do this game that's supposed to be relatively quick to get into. You know, you're just using a piece of paper and a pen, and you're keeping track of things in a very scrappy way. Reading a book of 200 rules feels like the complete opposite of how the situation should be if what you're getting out of it is some scrappily put together pages of notes. It just feels like the balance is completely wrong. I would say, ironically, it feels like that's more appropriate for something like a video game, but of course a video game takes all of that away from you and takes care of all the rules and the numbers and all that stuff. And so they don't need to have, you know, massive instruction manuals. And they used to do, but now video games, you know, they're all downloaded. So there's no space for a manual in the box because there's no box. So that sort of thing bothers me, and I prefer things to be minimal. One more example is I took part in a what's called a game jam recently, where you sort of follow a theme and submit a project based on that theme or those restrictions, whatever they happen to be. And this one was a 36-word RPG jam. And so you had to try and design a game where the rules fit into 36 words. So not just one page, but, you know, very few words. Before, the year before, they had 24-word RPG jam. The year before that, they had 12 words. I don't know how anyone did 12 words, but I got in at 36 words. And that was also quite popular because I think people sort of quite respect the gimmick in that sense. They like the idea that it's someone's trying to fit it into 36 words. But also in that case, it was a bit tricky because I was still trying to design it for solo play, which means no one else is involved in the playing of it. Whereas most of those 36-word RPGs, they're relying on the fact that there's a few people sitting around and they can all sort of join in with creating the world or deciding on the rules. And so that you're giving them more of a framework that they can fill in with their imagination. Whereas in my case, you have to give them everything. That's a lot harder in 36 words, but I really enjoy the challenge, and it grabs people's attention because it was probably one of the few solo games that fit into 36 words, and most of them probably went in a different direction.
I'm very curious to know, what was that game that you designed in 36 words?
I usually give them very basic, explicit titles, which you might be spotting a theme here with how I like to design things. But I think it was 36-word dungeon crawler or something. But the way I have arranged my profile on itch.io now, where all my games are, is that I've split them into categories. And so I have one section that is basically solo role-playing games that are based on a gimmick. And that's one of them, for example. So it's not necessarily a game you'd play for a long time. It's more there to show you that something can be done or that you might find interesting. Probably most people wouldn't get much enjoyment out of it. In that case, I had some people pick it up and do their own thing with it. One person translated it into, I think it was French. And one person was inspired by it and designed their own slightly bigger game, more expansive. They took the sort of bones of what I'd done and used it to inspire something larger, which actually ended up pretty impressive. So it's always nice when you can do that and it sort of gets remixed and there's a bit more of a community feel when you engage in that way, potentially in a bit more of a silly way, but it's also a way that people can easily engage with themselves beyond just, you know, downloading it and playing it.
Have you considered designing TTRPGs that are not solo, that either have, like, you have more than one player, but possibly maybe with a game master?
Yeah, so I did design one group role-playing game. It is with a game master as well. So there's someone running the game and there are people sort of taking part in the adventure. That was pretty much my only attempt. And I still tried to make it not gimmicky exactly, but I tried to make it as short as possible, but mechanically complete. And so often they leave a lot up to the imagination of the game master to like design the world or to come up with what's going to happen, and the imagination of the players to fill in the blanks. And I left in the player imagination, but I wanted something that someone who was new to that and a bit daunted by these hundreds of pages of rules in most RPGs could pick up and try out the concept very quickly. And there's a few games like that. There's a game like Lasers and Feelings, I think it's called, where they're essentially breaking it down into very simple concepts where you're saying you can either solve this problem with lasers, like, you know, combat, or feelings, you know, discussion or investigating a situation or something. And so they've broken it down to very simple sort of archetypes of action. I did something similar where I said, okay, your character's very simple. You just have to decide whether you are very strong, somewhat nimble, and not clever. Or you could add, you know, you could assign strong, somewhat, and not to any of those three in any combination, just so you could sort of vaguely represent the sort of character you wanted to be. Because if you play something like Dungeons & Dragons, which ironically I haven't, it's a huge character setup process. You can spend hours in your first session just choosing your characters in name and backstory and statistics and everything. And I find all of that a bit overwhelming. So I went in a different direction with this. That sort of simplicity runs through it all. So beyond choosing your own character and how strong, clever, and nimble you are, there's also tools in there for the game master to say, okay, roll a dice against this table. And that tells you what your overall goal is to give to the players. And maybe it's rescue someone, or maybe it's find an object. And so it gives you a vague structure, a vague outline of their sort of quest. And then you say, okay, and now you have to roll maybe three times on this table to decide what they have to do on the way, you know, to get to that goal. And so maybe they have to visit this tower, or maybe they run into some bandits over here. And so it basically lets you create this hierarchical structure to hang all of your imaginative stuff off, but gets you started very quickly. And so I basically took that concept, I won't explain all the rules, but I took that concept and applied it throughout the game so that it's all complete and you could just play it with those, I think it was three pages in the end. And that was one of my most popular sort of releases, I think, because again, it was taking something that everyone knows relatively well, which is group role-playing games, at least in that community, but trying to really simplify it down. And so if you wanted to introduce the concept to your children, for example, you don't necessarily want to convince them to sit down and spend hours coming up with character, you know, biographies and things. Maybe you could do something that takes 5 minutes to set up, see if they enjoy it, and then go from there, you know, build up the complexity over time. So when I do design non-solo role-playing games, they're usually also a bit gimmicky or explicitly structured in a way that makes them easier to get into. And one other example is that there was a game jam that encouraged you to use existing items from board games, like classic board games, to build an RPG around. And so I used the Monopoly board. And so instead of going around and getting properties, you're going around and facing enemies on each of the colored sort of property squares in Monopoly. So I had to change the rules a lot. It doesn't use all of the things, like it doesn't use the money from Monopoly, but it uses the structure of the Monopoly board to sort of simulate a dungeon crawl. And then you're playing that with other people competitively. So there's no game master. But if you stop on the, which I don't think was ever really an issue or a rule or concept in regular Monopoly, but in this game, if you stop on the same square as someone else, you can then fight that player. So there's this element of, I mean, you're rolling two dice and you can't really choose where you move, but there's an element of, when I do land on that person, do I want to fight them? Because I might, suffer from it, or I might benefit from it. There's a bit of strategy there. And, taking out your competitors is probably quite satisfying. So those are, I think, the two non-solo RPGs I've done, but they're definitely not normal as far as group RPGs go.
I want to go back to something you mentioned a bit earlier, and I'm talking about the world building, the narrative. There's always a balance, especially in solo TTRPGs, between how much the game itself gives you and how much work the player needs to do on their own in order to sort of create the world in their head and build that story for themselves. In your games, where do you see that balance?
Yeah, so I like my games to be mechanically complete, as in there's no need for the person to decide, oh, how should this be resolved? I also like it to have no interpretation. So essentially, I fall on the far, I'm not sure which side is which, but the far end of the spectrum as far as I want the game to give the player everything. And that doesn't necessarily mean the game is complex or many pages. It could be quite a simple game, but I don't want the player to ever have to stop and think, well, what should happen next? I want the game to tell them what happens next. If they happen to want to fill that out with their imagination, maybe stop and write a little description of the scene or something, if they're really into that sort of creative storytelling aspect, which I'm not personally, but I respect it, then I want to allow for that. But I don't want the person to ever have to wonder what they should do, except for strategically, of course. But I think part of the reason for that is that I definitely have an overactive imagination. But if someone asks me to imagine things sort of creatively on demand, for whatever reason, that's not a process I enjoy. I've always enjoyed, creative writing and things, just not when I'm playing a game. I think maybe it's that, just like how I read books, I want it to be an escape. I want it to be a fantasy of some kind, not necessarily the fantasy of the genre, but, I want my imagination to be sparked by the thing I'm reading, not for the thing I'm reading to require my imagination. I feel the same way in my games. I want to almost relax into it and see where it takes me, rather than, I think some people really like to put in a lot of work and they spend a long time writing backstories, and they, even if they're playing solo, they spend a long time basically journaling their experience, and they share their journals online, and it's essentially a creative outlet for them. And it's being guided by this game, these rule sets. And that's not what I enjoy about it. What I enjoy about it is the, not necessarily the challenge, but maybe the story that the game tells me. So yeah, I land at the far side of the spectrum. I'm not sure I'll ever write something that sort of moves towards the other end of the spectrum where it requires a lot of interpretation, or at least nothing big, just because it's not the sort of game I would enjoy playing myself.
Every medium, especially with games, has something that's unique about it, right? There's tabletop, like more traditional tabletop RPGs. We have a group of people and you have a person who's creating the story and reacting in real time to the players. In video games, that's kind of like the game master is abstracted and is being done by the computer to various degrees of success. Solo TTRPGs is you and the page and the rules. Where do you see the strength of solo TTRPGs and the weaknesses compared to those other forms of role-playing games?
I think strengths are, as a designer, the strength is that it's so much easier to produce. If I wanted to create a video game, it would be probably many years of effort, if not months. It depends how scrappy it is. But I can, and I have done, design a solo tabletop role-playing game in a matter of days. As that's very fun if you just want to explore a mechanic, or if you have an idea or a theme or something and you want to put something together and put it online. I released two things on my itch page in the last 2 days. And that's just because I had an idea and it was quick enough to make them that I could do each one in a day in my spare time. That feels great, especially as someone who works in software, which is related to the video game argument, that I can produce this complete artifact and release it into the world. And so I think that's a very strong strength as a designer. As a player, I think that it's very easy to get into, at least as long as you go for the mechanically less complex ones, because you often download a PDF and you can read it on your iPhone or your iPad, or print it out if you want to print out the 10 or so pages and shuffle them around. And there's not much more setup required from you than that, except for pen and paper, which most people have access to. And so if you imagine board games or things like, miniature war games like Warhammer is the most famous one, you're going to buy a lot of the stuff and set up all this terrain. You're going to have a huge kitchen table size table somewhere in your house, and you're going to have people come around and spend a good few hours playing them with you. And at various points in your life, all of those things can be hard to manage. You might not have the space or the money or the people. And so tabletop role-playing games are much easier to set up and play. For the more rules-heavy examples, it can be a bit of a slog reading through them. But I think there are some people who just enjoy reading through the rules and seeing what they're like, even if they never play them. And so there's a benefit there just for those people. I think those are the strengths. You know, you can do that while you're on a train, for example, whereas you can't really play Monopoly on the train. But if someone just sees you scratching a notebook on the train, they're not going to suspect you're playing a tabletop role-playing game. Maybe once you start rolling the dice, but you can get dice rolling apps on your phone that are very good. The weaknesses are that there are some inherent limits to that. Like you said, the computer is taking part of the person who's running the world for you in a video game. In a solo TTRPG, either the game has to foist all that complexity on you and make you do all the maths, and that can be quite slow. And people describe this, I didn't realize this is a term until recently, people describe it as bookkeeping in board games and role-playing games. They say, how much bookkeeping does this game require? And so some, you get this sort of character sheet that's basically an Excel spreadsheet. It's got cells for everything, and you're keeping track of all these different timers and things. It's very easy to forget to keep track of something. And a lot of them try to work that, a lot of the designers try to work their way around that with visual design, or, you know, the layout of the thing, try to design the perfect character sheet that helps you keep track of everything. But it's so easy to forget. And, you know, maybe you have this status applied to you as a player, as the player character, you know, and it's supposed to affect every role you do in the next three combats or something. You've got to remember that you've got to do that in the next three combats. You've got to remember what the status effect is without looking up in the book every time. You've got to remember to do the maths, you know, and take the number off your role every time. And so either that complexity gets foisted onto you, or the designer, like in my case, tries to eliminate it entirely. And so I try to avoid any complex maths, anything you have to remember between, you know, from one point in time to another one. And these are very similar to the rules you get in software design, where if you're making someone remember something from screen A to screen B, you've probably failed miserably along the way. In software, it's great that we have the option to do that, and we still forget to do it. But with a pen and paper role-playing game, we don't really have the option except to ask the player to remember those things, or to just eliminate the need to remember them. And that means that if you want to strike the ideal balance, often you're taking things out that you could include in a video game because it's all abstracted away and the computer is extremely good at remembering maths and status ailments. And then their only worry is to remind you that you have this applied, so maybe you can drink a potion or whatever it is to get rid of it. So I think that's the biggest weakness, is that you've got to take some things out that you'd otherwise like to have in mechanically, just because there's not an ever-present perfect being hovering over you to remember all this stuff like there is with a video game.
Whenever you create something and release it to the world, you have no control over how people are going to perceive it and use it. I'm curious to know, what are some of the more surprising feedback you've received from players of your game?
Feedback is annoyingly hard to come by. I see the download numbers for my games. I think the number of people who have visited my profile page is in the thousands, or the number of people who have viewed my games perhaps in thousands, and probably the number of people who have downloaded at this point is in the thousands. Obviously those numbers are wildly different, but they're both in the thousands. And even still, I've had, you know, tens of comments across all of my games where people have come back and said, I'm really enjoying this, or I like this, but here's some issues. So there's not a lot of feedback to choose from when you ask me what surprises me. I think sometimes it surprises me that people come back and say that they're really enjoying something that it feels like I whipped together in, you know, a few weeks in some cases, you know, if I put some more effort into it. One person commented and said, I've been playing this for the last 3 days and I'm really enjoying it. And to have produced, I know that I help design software that people use every day, you know, that's one thing, but you're working with a big company and they've got a big marketing, you know, engine helping them out. But to have made something that's basically a Word document and to put it online and for people to download it and then come back and say, I've been playing this for 3 days, is surprising in the best possible way, because it's absolutely mad that someone would spend 3 days on anything I've put together that's just text. I can understand if I'd made something really, you know, a AAA video game or something, if people were playing it for tens or hundreds of hours, that's one thing. Yeah, it's a pleasant surprise that there are people out there who are willing to put the time into this thing that I put the time into, and that community can sort of be created based on what is comparatively little effort in production, and for them to play it, you know, they're spending their time on something I spent my time on. It hasn't taken much time of either of our lives. Yeah, it's nice to get those comments. I'm not sure I've ever had any negative feedback except people who are pointing out typos, which I always appreciate, because maybe I've included the same word twice, or maybe there are some cases where I misspelled something or copied and pasted something but forgot to edit it. or, you know, someone's not sure if the text I wrote was mechanically relevant, and so I have to go back and put it in italics because that lets people know, oh, this is flavor text. You know, you can ignore this if you don't want the flavor. But all of that is helpful and not such a surprise. I'm glad people go and do that. I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest surprises is that some of the most popular games I've made are not the ones I put the most effort into, but the ones that I've put the most gimmicks into. And so I've not spent much time on them at all. It's sort of a funny idea, and people really pick up on them. Except there are some cases where I've done a gimmick and I thought it would be popular, and often they're not. I think this is the same with memes. You know, you're never sure what meme is going to be popular. In one case, I did a dungeon crawler called Dungeon Conga Line, I think it's called. And it's essentially everyone had a big party the night before, and they've all got really drunk and scattered across this dungeon. And so you, as the player character, are going around the dungeon finding partygoers who are in, you know, a bad state. And you start a conga line to go and collect them all. And so every new hero you come across joins the back of your conga line. And every time, the idea in my head was that every time they do the little kick in the conga dance, all of them let loose an attack. As you're sort of creating this centipede of death, as you're traveling through the, you know, any monsters you come across, if your conga line is long enough, don't stand a chance. But if your conga line's not big enough, then suddenly you're in trouble, you know. And so the end of the game is not when anyone dies, but when the party ends because everyone's gone home because they're a bit annoyed that they got stabbed by a goblin or something. I thought that was a really funny concept, but I don't think it got much traction at all when I released it. And so there's surprises there in terms of what's popular and what's not. And you really can't predict it. You know, you can't figure out the hook, even if you wanted to.
We've established in this conversation that you're a big fan of dungeon crawlers, not so much of solo journaling RPGs. Are there any sort of gimmicks or settings or ideas that you want to try in your future games?
I've started shifting a bit towards, and this comes back to my point of my definitions at the start, I've shifted a bit more towards the idea of solo board games. Generally, the production value on board games is a lot higher than role-playing games, just because one is usually just printed on paper and you're using paper to play it, and the other one, they provide a board. But there's this whole community of what's called print-and-play games, where people are designing games that have graphical elements and it's got physical pieces, and you're expected to print it out and at home and sort of craft it yourself. And usually they're a bit scrappy, so they're not too hard to put together. Some of them will be, you know, hundreds of cards the size of playing cards. And why anyone prints those out and puts the effort in to craft them, I don't know, because you're probably better off just buying the game, you know, the physical release. But there's this whole community there, and that's sort of that fired up my imagination. And so I've started looking into that, and I've started designing some more games that require printing, which is ironic. I don't have a printer at home, so I can't really do this. Sometimes I use a sort of print-on-demand service on the internet, but obviously I don't want to do that every day. It costs money, and you've got to wait for delivery, which is a long lead time. So I've been looking more into that, and that opens up new opportunities, because if you're tracking things on paper, often it can feel like a bit of a slog. If you're drawing your own dungeon rooms, unless it's a very compelling experience, you sometimes feel like, well, if I'm drawing my own dungeon rooms, why am I doing it at all? You know, the game's not providing me much in the way of sensory experience because I'm actually drawing things myself. But if you go for this board game approach, you could, for example, provide a map to the player that they can play on. And so maybe that feels a bit more special. So there's a spectrum there between pen and paper tabletop games and board games. And I think that one of the benefits of board games is that they provide a lot of the stuff that helps your imagination along, out of the box. So I've started to look at ways I could do that. And one of my most recent releases is not a game, actually. It's just like a tool people can use for their own dungeon crawls. But it's essentially four tiles, and each one has six rooms in it for a dungeon, but in a random configuration. Essentially, every tile is unique. But if you print out those four tiles, they all connect at the sides. And so you could put them in essentially any arrangement, rotation, any order or grouping. And I asked ChatGPT to tell me how many unique combinations that is. And you end up with 30,000 different combinations of possible dungeon layouts. More if you just say, oh, I want a short dungeon, so I'll just use two tiles, or I'll use, you know, all four for a large dungeon. And so you get even more in that case. And so I realized that sort of thing, you know, it's not much effort to design it or to print it out, but suddenly it gives you a lot of opportunities and possibilities. And you're not asking anyone to have to draw things themselves, which, just like my sort of hesitation around imagining things, if you're asking people to draw maps, probably there's a segment of the population out there that would rather not draw maps and would rather pull out a Monopoly board and play on that, for example. So yeah, I'm shifting more towards that. So it's not really a gimmick or a setting necessarily, but it is a sort of a mechanical approach that is quite exciting, as long as I can keep it, you know, down to earth and minimal still, because some of these board games you can buy have, you know, 300 pieces in the box, and that's a complete turnoff for me. I don't want to have something the size of, you know, a bread bin on my shelf taking up space when I'm not playing it, and then for it to take 2 hours to set up and 2 hours to take down. That seems like a bad proposition to me, so I'll try to keep it sort of low footprint still.
Where does the quite large solo TTRPG community come into the picture for you? Are you engaged with it?
So I think it's hard to find people who are discussing game design in a way that I can engage with. I think there's a lot of this sort of thing happening on Discord servers, but I've never really engaged with Discord as an app. There is the Board Game Geek website, which, as the name suggests, leans more towards board games, but there's a lot of crossover between board games and solo tabletop role playing games. And so you can go on to the forums at Board Games Geek and also the forums at Itch, where I upload all my games. There are people there who are designing games naturally, and they often hang around in the forums talking to each other about game design or asking for recommendations. But I found that it's not as common as I'd like. There's not as many topics posted every day, for example, on the forums. Where people are getting deep into the weeds of game design. And so I suspect some of those communities end up gravitating towards more famous designers in the space. I think there are some people who design a lot of, well, they spend basically full time designing role-playing games. I think people spend time in their communities and a lot of the discussion happens there. But obviously that's all centered around that one person. And so probably any discussion that doesn't really relate to their games might be, you might get some pushback for that. In terms of discussion, there's not a great place I've found yet. But none of this would be possible for me without Itch. So itch.io allows you to upload your games for free. It allows you to charge for your games if you want to. And all of mine happen to be free. I do plan to release a paid game at some point, but you know that's in the works. If there wasn't this platform there that all of these scrappy indie game designers are going to upload their games, I think it would have been almost pointless to start because I wouldn't have known where to put them. There's not really a better community to share that sort of thing on. So that is how the community is represented in my mind, is the fact that Itch exists. There are people who are mad enough to start this site and share it around and let people use it for free. It's popular enough that you can upload a game and the next day have, you know, 50 people have downloaded it and hopefully they're playing it. I suspect a lot of them download it and just digitally hoard it, like I've done with some games, and they never get around to it, which is a shame. But it's nice to see the numbers go up.
Anthony, where can people find you?
Yeah, so if you go to itch.io, I put all my games under my name, Anthony Hobley. I had this sort of eventual dream, if I did start selling games, I would rebrand to Grey Squirrel Games, because I'm a particular fan of Grey Squirrels. And so I think, you know, that would lend itself to a better logo than if I stayed Anthony Hobley for my games company. Yeah, if you search for Anthony Hobley, they're all there. You can also go to my website, anthonyhobley.com, if you're particularly interested in my design career. Because I think there's a strong connection between designing software and designing role-playing games and board games. There's a lot of rules you have to figure out. I think that's maybe what appealed to me about the whole process. If you happen to like the way I think, then maybe you'll also like the way I think about design.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's unusual to talk for this long to anyone about tabletop role-playing game design. Like I said, there's not many people around you can talk to about it.
Always happy to nerd out about games.
Thank you.
This is all for this episode of Design Downtime. Thank you for joining me, and until next time, I hope you enjoy your downtime.